Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart. All right. How often do you click on links to articles online beginning with the words, a new study finds? From sleep and sex to alcohol and chocolate, there are countless reports on the benefits of one and the deadly risks of another. So where can we turn for unbiased, trusted health advice in a world of misinformation that runs rampant on the internet? On today's Please Explain, Dr. Nina L. Shapiro, Director of Pediatric Ear, Nose, and Throat at the Mattel Children's Hospital, UCLA, and professor at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA, debunks medical myths, health fads, and misconceptions. Her latest book is titled Hype, A Doctor's Guide to Medical Myths, Exaggerated Claims, and Bad Advice, How to Tell What's Real and What's Not, published by St. Martin's Press. Dr. Nina Shapiro, welcome to Please Explain and Midday on WNYC.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And I should tell the audience, if you have questions about medical myths, fads, and advice, give us a call. The number is 212-433-9692. So, Dr. Shapiro, you work as a surgeon at UCLA. How has being a surgeon shaped the way you interpret news about the latest and greatest new procedure, technology, or technique?
Well, being a surgeon has really helped me think about how to bash hype. We can't do the latest and greatest surgery and just expect the latest and greatest outcomes from just changing something very quickly. We use an expression, technology is no substitute for technique. And one of the things that we as surgeons specifically deal with is risk. People have this notion, and you know, there's some validity to it, that surgery is the riskiest thing to do. And what I find in my practice is sometimes not doing surgery can be riskier than doing surgery. Not having any sort of intervention can bring more risk than having an intervention. So it's kind of interesting to see how people think about something that's quote unquote interventional or invasive as being the most drastic and the most dangerous thing to do, when oftentimes that's actually not the case.
I got to ask you, what sparked this book? I mean, you're a surgeon. You've got a lot to do. I can't imagine that you have a lot of free time. Was there some report that came out or something that made you think, this is nuts, I need to get to the bottom of this and cut all of this, bash all of this hype, as you said?
Well, it's funny that you mentioned nuts, because actually, you know, I live in Los Angeles, which is the land of hype and exaggeration and health. So, you know, one of the things that has been both vilified but also considered very healthy is something like nuts. And there are families that I take care of that give nuts to their very little children, even children, you know, just about a year old, which are very high choking risks. So there's always that paradox between giving something really healthy, but that can potentially cause a problem. So for instance, nuts are a very significant choking risk for very young children, but families, certainly in my town and probably in your town too, give nuts to children thinking that it's healthy, but they can actually choke. So I think that sort of the tipping point was, you know, hearing and seeing families who really genuinely want to do good by their children and do good by the rest of their families, but they can absolutely be putting them in danger, giving them something dangerous, or for instance, in this town and in many large cities, not vaccinating, thinking that that's actually going to be healthy when it's actually extremely dangerous to do things like that.
I'm still trying to get over the fact that people are trying to feed nuts to infants, not even trying to crush them or anything.
Oh, absolutely. And they think that they can chew and they're safe. And that brings us to, you know, the notion of what's safe. Well, my child has never had a problem, so therefore my child doesn't need to, you know, to follow these guidelines. And again, that carries to other issues. I've never had the flu, so I don't need a flu shot. My child has never seen, you know, these horrible illnesses, so they don't need to be immunized. So you know, it's a very interesting, somewhat insular notion of health that really just locks into one's family as opposed to extending into, you know, general guidelines and public health as well, which is a real concern.
Again, if you have any questions about medical myths, fads, advice, give us a call, 212-433-9692. Dr. Shapiro, you write that that medicine has changed tremendously in the 25 years since you became a doctor. But the question is, have patients also changed in those 25 years?
I think patients have absolutely changed in the last 25 years, and even more recently, as we have more and more access to information. In the past, you know, even a decade or two ago, the notion of looking up a medical article involved going to a hospital's library. And patients wouldn't ever consider doing, you know, or extremely rarely would they consider doing something like that. But now the access to information has changed patients, I think. And for the most part, this has been for the good, because patients now come armed with some information. They're more educated on potential problems. So for the most part, patients have changed for the better because they are much more health savvy. I think the negative has become more and more of an us and them, the healthcare versus the patient, the doctor versus the patient, us and them. And, you know, there's been much more sort of conspiracy theory notion that it's the healthcare industry that's out to get the patients, or pharmaceutical industries, as opposed to just everybody wants to be healthier, doctors included.
Well, Dr. Shapiro, I have to ask you this, because, I mean, great, you know, you've got people coming in, they're more health savvy, but where are they getting this information that makes them more savvy than they were 25 years ago? Are there trusted sites that people can go to where they know they can be reasonably assured that the information they are getting is actually right, true, and just?
I think there are trusted sites, and you know, I think the less glitzy the website, the more pure information that it provides, gives great information to doctors and to patients. I think that, you know, if patients are concerned about a problem, I always recommend that if you're going to do an internet search, to start really basic and just one word or two word symptoms, as opposed to what you think you might have. Educational sites are very helpful, and not necessarily to give you the diagnosis, but to lead you towards how to seek further information, who to call, when to call. So there are many informative sites from an educational standpoint. A lot of the, you know, for instance, the CDC or the Academy sites, the American Academy of Pediatrics, American Medical Association, those provide excellent resources for, you know, both for doctors and for patients.
I remember when I went to my doctor for my physical, and she said, you know, there's this thing, we're going to double check, but don't go on the internet. Leave it alone. Don't go on the internet. You'll drive yourself crazy. I'm speaking with Dr. Nina Shapiro, Director of Pediatric Ear, Nose, and Throat at the Mattel Children's Hospital at UCLA and Professor at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. We'll be right back after a break. You are listening to Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart. And here today for this week's Please Explain is Dr. Nina Shapiro. She is the author of the book Hype, A Doctor's Guide to Medical Myths, Exaggerated Claims, and Bad Advice, How to Tell What's Real and What's Not. And to that point, I said before the break that my doctor told me, don't look on the internet. Just don't do it. And I'm just wondering, let's say I ignored my doctor's advice and I had gone on the internet. How would I be able to tell if a website is legitimate?
So there is actually a lot of good information on the internet, you know, for medical problems and health issues. And I think what your doctor was saying is, you know, if you're concerned about a problem, you will easily find it on the internet, and you will find the most extreme, most exaggerated, worst case scenario. You know, when you look at any website, you look at the three letters after the dot. So is it a .com, a .gov, a .edu? So a .com is a commercial website. So again, it doesn't mean it's necessarily inaccurate or wrong, but there's a commercial side to it. So there will, by nature, be some bias to that site. They may be selling something, they may be advertising. So you just have to keep that in mind and, you know, sort of buyer beware when you look at a site like that. A .edu is an educational site, and that usually has the purest information. It won't be, swayed towards a particular drug or a particular surgery or a particular intervention. It's purely informational. .gov is also pretty, in my opinion, it's pretty unbiased. You know, certainly there are people that are concerned that the government is sort of out to get us when it comes to our health. But, you know, sites such as the CDC site or the National Institutes of Health site, with the .gov at the end, have pure data. People oftentimes get concerned and feel sort of that it's a little too impersonal when it's just data provided to them. But this data is based on thousands and thousands of people over many years, so it's actually the most valuable information for a given problem. It's not going to be as interesting and perhaps not as nice to look at, but it will give you probably the purest information about a medical issue.
So, Dr. Shapiro, why have antibiotics become more and more dangerous since the 80s?
So, you know, the beginning of antibiotics was a wonder. It saved thousands of lives because people were dying of these horrible infections. But the problem is antibiotics have been so overused over the past decades that there has been creation of newer and higher level antibiotics, and now we are needing to give adult dosed antibiotics to children.
Jeez.
Because of that they just don't work for all of the organisms. We've all heard of these terms, super bugs. And you know, in part, you know, it's the doctors and you know, that we've overused antibiotics unnecessarily, and we've created this antibiotic resistance for illnesses that are mostly viruses where you don't even need an antibiotic. So the danger is that if you give an antibiotic, you may kill some of the bacteria, but then the stronger ones will survive and you'll have a much more serious infection. So we've really tried to sort of hone in and not overprescribe antibiotics for things that are really not bacterial infections, but it continues to be a problem.
Dr. Shapiro, we have Elizabeth from Brooklyn on the line. Elizabeth.
Hi. I read a Mother Jones article not long ago that linked alcohol and cancer. And I had never heard anybody talk about that before, including my own doctor. And I didn't know. It looked really well researched, but I, you know, why is this something we don't hear more about? If it's true, and if it's not true, I guess my red wine and I would like to know.
Me too.
Cheers. So, you know, that you use the word linked, which is very interesting because you can link one thing to another. And, you know, I think the thing that they didn't, I haven't seen this Mother Jones article, but what they didn't do is say that alcohol causes cancer. And, you know, and then the question is, you know, was this study, how many people, over how much time, how much alcohol? If you abuse alcohol, it will increase your risk of liver cancer. That we know. But anything in moderation, and there's actually a study that's just being started, and it's interesting because it's co-funded by the National Institutes of Health and an alcohol, one of the beer companies, to look forward and see what people do if they drink one drink, two drinks, three drinks. Most of the very large population studies that have been done over several decades show that drinking in moderation, meaning one to two glasses of, you know, wine or its equivalent per day with a meal, can have good effects to your health. Now, with a huge caveat, that doesn't mean that if you're not drinking, you should start drinking and that will make you healthier. But saying that alcohol causes cancer is a huge leap that really, you know, can be misconstrued. And again, it's not that it's right or wrong, but it's hype. It's exaggerated. And you can't look at one study and say that this is, you know, enjoy your red wine.
Elizabeth, thank you. Thank you for your call. Dr. Shapiro, thank you for saving red wine for me and Elizabeth.
Good red wine.
Right.
Drink
yes.
The good stuff first.
Yes, absolutely. Good red wine. So I want to talk about chemicals, because when shopping for cosmetics and toiletries, we often see these labels with words like paraben-free and phthalate-free. What are these, and are they actually harmful?
So, you know, chemical is a nasty word, and everything has, you know, a chemical just means a substance made up of a group of of molecules or ions. So, you know, we always get, you know, very concerned when we see the word chemical. And certainly, you know, one of the reasons why skin creams are so soft and plastics are so pliable and we can put plastics in our microwaves is because of all of these added chemicals. And, you know, there have been studies that show that some of them, you know, BPA was a big one that mm-hmm. was found to have some effects on hormone disruption, and that was now removed from plastics, certainly involving, you know, the use of plastics in children. But, you know, the concern is that if there's such a minuscule amount of some of these chemicals, does it translate to a negative impact on one's health? And for the most part, they don't. You know, certainly when anything toxin or whatever buzzword we'd like to use is used to excess, there are potential risks. But a lot of the labels that you see in the pharmacy or in the grocery store or in a beauty counter where they are putting made with or made without is a bit of a marketing tool to make it seem healthier. One of my favorites is fragrance-free.
I love fragrance-free because I don't want it the fragrance in the lotion to mess up my cologne. Telling me, is it really fragrant? It's not fragrance.
It's fragrance-free, but they have to put something in it to make it fragrant, to block the natural fragrance. So sometimes it doesn't necessarily, people think that fragrance-free or, you know, if it's paraben-free or phthalate-free, completely equates to healthy. So it's fine to have it fragrance-free if you don't want it to smell a certain way. You don't want to smell like an apple orchard or a mango tree or some sort of funny, you know, fruity flavor that they add. But they have to add something to block the fragrance. So it doesn't necessarily mean that it's healthier.
Fine. Let's Dr. Shapiro, we have Peter from Manhattan on the line. Peter.
Yes, hello.
Yes.
Why are diseases reoccurring that were once pretty much thought of as being eliminated? Has immigration played a role in this?
Which diseases in particular? Vaccine-preventable diseases?
Children diseases, all kinds of things have reoccurred. And lastly,
measles, mumps, those sorts
right.
of diseases.
Right. So I think, you know, it's purely based on that people are choosing not to immunize their children. People in this country, some of the largest measles epidemics have been in the Los Angeles area and in large cities where families choose to delay vaccines.
Okay.
Pure and simple.
And I want to confront something that Peter said head on since before he cut out, he said it. He asked the question about whether there is a link to immigration. Can you debunk that bit of hype?
I think that it has little or nothing to do with immigrants. I think it has to do with people living in this country choosing not to immunize. We have a very high immunization resistance rate. There are certain countries that are in need of more immunizations and, you know, hopefully are getting provided, you know, better immunization rates. But the majority, from what I've seen in the news, and there are usually these pockets of outbreaks, are from people born and living in this country who are not immunizing.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask you this question, but I'm going to have Chris in Brooklyn ask this question because, it's better coming from a listener than coming from me. Chris.
Hi.
Hi.
I was wondering, do we have enough data at this point on studies to figure out if cell phones are dangerous for you? I have one to my head right now, and I am too lazy to use my headphones. But is that bad? Do we know?
You know, that's a great question about cell phones and cancer. And there have been some studies, very important studies in neurosurgical journals, and they haven't really given the it causes or it doesn't cause. There have been some studies, and really on both ends of the spectrum, that have shown that there has been a link of increased cell phone use and certain tumors, and then other studies, similarly sized studies, that have shown the complete opposite. So we don't yet have the answer. I will say one thing about cell phones, that they cause more car accidents than they have in the past, just from people being on their phones while they're driving. And, you know, the harmful texts and social media have caused deaths from suicide due to, you know, bullying and everything that goes along with that. But as far as not having your head, not having your earpiece or carrying your cell phone and, you know, wearing it on your ear while you speak, it's the jury is still out on that one.
I seem to recall back in the mid-90s when a high-powered businessman died of brain cancer. And one of the questions was, hey, was that because of cell phones? So it's interesting, 20 years out, we're still asking that question for a device that we're all using now compared to the time when he was using it. Dr. Shapiro, what is the number one cause of death before age 45?
Accidents.
Of all kinds.
Easy. Accidents of all kinds. We are so focused on doing these things for our health, which are for the most part good, but the very boring basics that don't make headlines, that aren't going to be a tweet or a soundbite, are the ways that we can live healthier and longer. Wear your seatbelt, have your child sit in the back seat, facing rear if they're under two, bicycle helmets, not texting and driving, wearing sunscreen, staying out of the sun. These are all such basic things to help relatively young people stay healthy.
And what about for those of us older than 45, what's the number one cause of death?
Then we don't need to wear our seatbelts, no.
and drink as much wine as you want per day.
Exactly. More red, the better. So, you know, as we get older, there are increased risks of cancer and heart disease. And again, this isn't something that I'm saying just because you're under 44, you shouldn't, you know, look, you know, take care of yourself and do things to prevent cancer and stay healthy and eat well and exercise. But, you know, those sorts of actual risks of dying or developing a horrible disease develop, you know, are seen later in life. You know, the issue is just because, again, they pop up in your 50s, 60s, and 70s, you get there by, you know, a lot having to do with your lifestyle. If you eat poorly, if you smoke, if you don't get enough sleep, if you have a lot of stress, then all of these, you know, heart disease, cancers, are at increased risk later in life.
But before we go to our next caller, that brings to mind those crazy stories about the person who was super healthy and they were a runner or a swimmer or a marathoner, mm-hmm. and then yeah. they dropped dead.
Yep.
How does that, I mean, is that a genetic thing? Does that go back to the lifestyle thing you were talking about or what?
You know, it's a little, and we all have had, you know, we've either heard about or we know people who've had these horrible tragedies, exactly as you said, healthy, slim, runner, active, and they literally drop dead in the middle of a marathon or after a workout, and these are devastating, horrible events, you know, oftentimes, and you hear about these young athletes, even, you know, in high school, who have these sudden deaths, and usually it's from a very rare what's called an arrhythmia, so an abnormal heart rhythm that leads to their death. That's one of the most common causes of an otherwise healthy person, you know, dying suddenly. And then, you know, we also hear about these healthy people who develop a horrible, untreatable cancer mm-hmm. that, you know, would typically be thought of, you know, for instance, lung cancer or throat cancer, where you would normally think about someone who was a longtime smoker or alcohol abuser developing a, you know, what would be thought of as a preventable cancer. And these horrible things do happen, and it's a combination of genetics, environment, immune status, even. We don't always know why some people, you know, have these horrible diseases and rear their ugly heads in an otherwise healthy person. Thankfully, it's relatively rare, though.
Dr. Shapiro, we have Eddie from Fairfield, New Jersey on the line. Eddie, your question.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
I was just wondering why doctors don't prescribe like a lot of holistic stuff. I know they can't make money on it. That's probably one of the reasons. But supposedly, I was reading that vitamin B17 cures cancer, cannabis oil cures cancer, and a drug called Ibogaine, which is not available here, but I think it's in Europe, can cure an addict within 30 hours of one dose. So I'm just wondering why these things are not widely available in the United States. I know, I remember when people became doctors to help people not become millionaires. So that, does that have something to do with it?
Oh, thanks for your call,
that's
Eddie.
So, you know, that's an important point. And I think, you know, people who sell holistic medication, you know, actually make millions. The alternative medication medicine industry is a big moneymaker, and people do have access to these medications. I think that, you know, physicians often wait until things are approved and studied more long term. You know, certainly not only the efficacy or whether something works, but the safety of a lot of these treatments. You know, you brought up cannabis, which is interesting because you know, medical marijuana is used, you know, here certainly in Los Angeles. Readily with great effects and benefits. But, you know, as far as other medications that are not fully tested for safety and efficacy in the United States, I think, you know, there's a little bit more hesitancy.
Again, Eddie, thank you for your call. Let's go to Jessica in Rockland County with her question. Jessica.
Hi. I'm just wondering about, you know, you were talking about the overuse of antibiotics a little while ago, and I'm wondering about the antibacterial soaps and the antibacterial rinses. I feel like, wouldn't they have the same effect, and should they not be used long-term as well?
That's a great question.
Yeah, so, you know, all of the magic soap, we call it, for the kids, or, you know, the soap that you carry in your purse, and then, you know, obviously all the antibacterial soaps. You know, there has been concern that we are, you know, it's normal to have some bacteria on your skin, and most of your body actually carries a lot of bacteria and viruses, which are fine. And do we need to knock every single bacteria out every time we wash our hands? The answer is no. And we're seeing, you know, there's something called MRSA, which is used to be a very rare hospital-acquired infection with a very difficult staph infection to treat. We're now seeing it in the office routinely, and it probably in part because we're knocking out the healthy bacteria on our skin too much. I think regular soap and water certainly does the job. Unless you don't have access to a sink, then I think those antibacterials certainly have some value.
What about, let me jump in on this. What about the hand sanitizer stuff? That's part of that whole crew of antibacterial soaps, right?
It is, and I think, you know, part of that, the antibacterial, the hand wipes or the hand sanitizer, is this notion of we're always on the go. We have to have a little packet of food in our pocket or in our purse, and we have to have a little packet of antibacterial that, you know, we're too busy to have access to soap and water at a sink. And, you know, and I think if you're out and about and your hands get dirty and you feel like you want to wash your hands and you don't have access, it's fine to use one of those, you know, the hand wipes or the you know, portable antibacterials. But it's certainly overused and this notion of having to, you know, sterilize and sanitize every inch of us is first of all, it's impossible. And it's not really necessary.
And it's gross. My mom's always offering me the hand sanitizer things. Like, nope, I want to fight the superbug when it comes.
Yeah, you've got an immune system. Use it.
Right. So can we talk about these diets and cleanses? Are cleanses actually healthy for you?
So, you know, we have this notion of that, you know, we're contaminated. So if we don't have antibacterial soap, we need to cleanse ourselves internally. You know, cleanses are, you know, if you feel better after doing a cleanse, then go for it. Do a cleanse. Is it really necessary for your health? No. You know, because you have, assuming you are relatively healthy, you have an internal detox center. You have an internal filter. It's called your liver and your kidneys and your gastrointestinal tract and your mouth that chews food. So we're built to kind of cleanse our bodies. We don't need to buy products to do that. But, you know, that said, if you feel better doing a cleanse, then do it, you know, if you have the luxury to do that and to buy it. But it's certainly not necessary. We've really become more and more obsessed with our diets, how we eat, how we chew food. You know, everything is sort of blended now. And there's no evidence that it's really necessary.
Do superfoods really exist?
So there are a lot of foods that are super good for you. Berries are one of them. I feel it. It's kind of fun. The harder it is to pronounce, the better it must be for you. Acai and quinoa, turmeric, they're all great for you. But there's no magic kale. There is no magic food. There's no food that's going to completely prevent cancer. There's no one magic answer to that. They're foods that are healthy, ideally if they're chewed. The superfood when I was growing up was pasta.
Right? Oh, real quick, the music is up, but I've got to ask you this because we all live by the tyranny of that step counter on our phones.
Oh, yeah.
Can we actually, does that even matter, these steps, the 10,000 steps?
So the number 10,000 is somewhat arbitrary, but I will say it's important to be active. If you are up and about several times per day and get 8,000 steps, don't beat yourself up. If you sit for 23 hours a day and then run around to get 12,000 steps, probably fewer steps but more frequent activity is healthier.
Dr. Nina Shapiro, thank you very much for being here today on today's Please Explain.